Lecture 14, A Sustainable Trade Balance.
With this lecture, we will complete the fourth of the four main goals of macroeconomic policy. We've talked about faster growth, lower unemployment, lower inflation, and now what we want to talk about is a sustainable balance of trade. The trade balance is perhaps one of the least understood of any of the mainstream economic statistics. In fact, I think it is misunderstood in a fundamental way by many journalists and most of the general public. So what I want to try and do in this lecture is lay out both what the trade balance really is in the way economists think about it and what it means to economists, which has some interesting implications for how one thinks about trade in general. The most common measure of trade's balance is to simply look at imports and exports. Imports, of course, are what is bought by U.S. consumers and businesses from producers in other countries, and exports are things made by producers in the United States and then sold abroad. When we talk about the trade deficit or the balance of trade, we're somehow talking about the balance between exports and imports. If exports are bigger than imports, we say we've got a trade surplus. If imports are greater than exports, then we have a trade deficit. Now, that measure worked okay for days when trade was ships filled with cargo. Imports and exports, in the simple way I was just talking about it, are measures of goods. They're like cars or refrigerators, items, physical items you can pick up and carry around with you. But now we live in a different time. We live in a time when more than half of our gross domestic product is services, remember. We live in a time when services are bought and sold internationally, when movies and software and financial instruments are all moving back and forth across financial borders. And in that world, this very simple-minded idea of the trade deficit, that is to say, look at imports of goods, look at exports of goods, and balance the two out, is old-fashioned and out of date. It's known in particular as the merchandise trade balance or the merchandise trade deficit to emphasize that what you're looking at when you look at that measure is just merchandise. You're not looking at all the other stuff in the economy. If you want an overall measure of the trade balance, you need to look at some other things as well. So let's take an overall look at a broad measure of the trade balance. And that overall measure is known as the current account balance or the current account deficit. The first ingredient of the current account balance is actually the merchandise trade deficit. So we take exports and imports, we look at those two, just of goods, and in 1997, for example, imports of goods into the U.S. were much bigger than exports out. It was $199 billion bigger. So we had a merchandise trade deficit of $199 billion. However, if you looked at the services, the U.S. actually has a trade surplus, not only in 1997, but we've had a trade surplus in goods for the last several decades. What are the services that are bought and sold internationally? It seems a quirky thing when you think about it. A lot of the services that come to mind, if you just offhand think services, are things like haircuts or cleaning your house or something like that. And those kinds of items are obviously hard to ship overseas. But an awful lot of services, like advertising, like finance, like law, are all things which can be and are shipped internationally. They're sold by U.S. companies to firms abroad and vice versa. However, the U.S. is a real leader in service-oriented trade. And so in 1997, we actually had a surplus of $85 billion in services trade. So if you were to add up merchandise trade and services trade, the overall trade deficit for the U.S., instead of being almost $200 billion, if you just looked at the merchandise trade balance, would be more like $114 billion. Quite a significant difference. However, if we're going to get an overall view of trade, there are two more ingredients that economists want to include. One is income from past foreign investments. Now, if you look at what that means, we think about U.S. investors who've put money abroad and are getting income back from those investments. And we think about foreign investors who've put money in the U.S. and are getting money back from those investments. We balance out the two flows of return on investment. And in 1997, the U.S. on net paid out $14 billion more than we received from our investments abroad. On investment income, in other words, we had a trade deficit of $14 billion. The fourth and final ingredient of the current account balance is unilateral transfers. The simplest of the unilateral transfers to think about is just foreign aid. If the U.S. government gives money to another government, then that's just that just counts as part of the money which is flowed overseas. Or a slightly less common way to think about it, but something which is probably more important in the real world, is U.S. workers who send money overseas to family members or out of the country to family members. That works in a way like foreign aid, except if you think about it, it's private foreign aid rather than public foreign aid. These last two ingredients, investment income and unilateral transfers, seem odd to many people. It seems odd to include them in the balance of trade statistics. Most people are pretty comfortable including services. That doesn't bother them a whole lot. But this business about investment income and transfers somehow bugs them. So let me try and justify why they should be included and why on an intuitive level it makes sense to include them. Investment income you can really think of as a service of its own. In this case, the service, though, is renting capital. If we provide a service to Japan, which is, say, advertising services for someone over in Japan, then that clearly is something that we've exported to them. If we provide Japan with investment capital, someone puts investment capital over in Japan and waits for a return to come in, they're also providing a service. It's a capital market service of providing capital that can be used over there, and you should be paid for providing that service. So when you think about investment income, really it's right to think of it as just another kind of service. It just happens to be a service which is provided through the capital market and paid as a return on investment rather than provided through the goods and services market and paid with an invoice. Transfers work somewhat the same way. When you think about what we're providing for a transfer, we're shipping money abroad, and if we were to, say, buy a product from another country, we would send them our dollars. They would sell here, we would import the product, and dollars would go overseas. Well, with unilateral transfers, we're not getting the product, but we are still shipping the money overseas. So in an economic sense, the money which is being shipped overseas works as if there had been some product shipped here. Again, there wasn't actually a product, but it works as if a product had been shipped here. In some cases, this connection between unilateral transfers and goods is particularly clear. One of those examples was during the Gulf War against Iraq in 1991. As some of you may remember, during that war, the United States charged other countries. They said, "You have to pay for our troops going overseas." So, in that year, unilateral transfers, which usually are a negative for the United States, it's usually money flowing from the U.S. abroad, actually turned into a small positive, because there was a lot of money being paid by other countries to the United States that was just counted as a unilateral transfer. In that case, it was really a payment for the service, the military services, that the U.S. defense establishment had provided in the Gulf. So when we think about transfers and investment income, the reason they get included really at a gut level is because they involve flows of money going back and forth just like there had been goods or services. And we can indeed think about the reasons for those money flows as involving intangible goods and services or foreign policy goals and other kinds of services. So in order to get an overall measure of the trade balance, we want to add up these four things: the merchandise trade balance, the service trade balance, the investment income balance, and unilateral transfers. In 1997, if you add those four up for the United States, you get an overall trade deficit of $166 billion, as measured by the current account balance. And that measure, the current account balance, is really what economists are talking about when they talk about the overall trade deficit. It's the broad measure that takes everything into account. What's been the U.S. experience with trade over the last few decades? If one starts at the end of World War II and works forward up until about 1970, what you see is that in most years the United States is running small surpluses in the current account balance, almost every year. But although there are surpluses most years, in general the trade picture is pretty close to balanced trade. That there's not a big deficit when there's a deficit, there's not a big surplus when there's a surplus. In the 1970s, the U.S. economy starts running smallish trade deficits. And by the end of the 1970s, there's a trade deficit, for example, of $15 billion in 1978, relatively big for the time. A lot of that was traced at the time back to imported oil. Remember, in the 1970s, the price of oil goes up dramatically. We're importing a lot of oil. And so The price of U.S. imports had gone up a lot. But by the early 1980s, again, the U.S. has a little surplus, and it sort of looks like we're back in our world of not big surpluses, not big deficits. Then in the early 1980s, the trade deficit just explodes. It behaves in a shocking and unexpected fashion. Let me give you the trade deficits for a few years in the early 1980s. In 1980, we have a current account surplus of $2 billion. 81, a surplus of $5 billion. In 82, we have a current account deficit of $11 billion. So we're still in our world of little surpluses, little deficits. 1983, a deficit of $44 billion. 1984, a deficit of $100 billion. 1985, a deficit of $123 billion. 1986, a deficit of $150 billion. 1987, a deficit of $167 billion. So we went from a world of little surpluses and deficits over a period of decades and decades to within about 5 years in the mid-1980s, zipping all the way to a trade deficit of $167 billion. Then if you look at the trade deficit figures, the trade deficit zips back, and in 1991, with the help of those unilateral transfers for the Gulf War, we actually have a small, or almost back to balance in 1991 in terms of our trade deficit. By the late 1990s, however, we've fallen all the way back to a trade deficit of $166 billion again in 1997. So when you look at the pattern of the trade deficit since about 1980, you see enormous swings. The trade deficit suddenly becomes very large, much larger than it had historically been. It falls almost all the way back to zero, and then it becomes very large again. When we think about understanding or explaining the trade deficit, you need to hold that pattern in mind because it'll be important for thinking about what the underlying causes might be. So let's think about the underlying meaning of the trade deficit. And in order to think about underlying causes, it's important to come to grips with what the trade deficit really means to economists. This is a difficult issue. I'd say that in most courses I teach, this is one of the single most difficult points to get across to folks. So try and set your preconceptions aside on this subject for just a moment and follow the logic of the argument as best I can make it for you. Any of the things which are on the surplus side of the trade picture involve money that's flowing into the United States. For example, if we export to another country, then their money is flowing from there into this country. If we export services, money's flowing into this country. If we think about, on the other side, the negative or the deficit side of the trade picture, that always involves money flowing out of the country. So if we import a good from abroad, money is flowing from here to a producer in another country. If we think about unilateral transfers, money is flowing here to another country. If we think about investment income is flowing from here to investors in other countries. So when we think about the trade picture, when we think about the pluses and the minuses, one way to think about it is to think about these two flows of capital that are coming toward each other from different countries. Now, when I talk about the trade picture, and when anyone talks about the trade picture, it's really common to put it all into U.S. dollars. Because after all, we want a common measuring stick. It's useful to think about things in terms of U.S. dollars. But if you think about trade for a moment, you realize that this image of it all being U.S. dollars is clearly wrong. If a U.S. Firm sells something in Germany, the person pays with German marks. And so it's those German marks which are flowing toward the United States. If a Japanese firm sells something in the United States, the U.S. consumer pays with dollars, and then we have somehow U.S. dollars flowing toward Japan. So when we think about these flows of trade going back and forth, these flows of money, they're not just flows of one currency, like U.S. dollars. They're actually flows of a variety of different currencies, all of which have to be exchanged somehow. Next step in the argument. Remember that when you produce something in a given country, your expenses and your investors are all in that country. When a U.S. firm sells something over in Germany and they get German marks, they have to think to themselves, okay, I need to pay my workers back in the U.S. in U.S. dollars. I need to pay my investors back in the U.S. in U.S. dollars. I need to pay my suppliers back in the U.S. in U.S. dollars. So they want to take those German marks, or whatever currency they earned abroad, and switch it back into dollars using the banking system and the finance system. Similarly, if you look at the other side of things, everyone who sells in the United States needs to get back and make their own expenses work in their own country.
So if a British firm sells in the United States, they say, well, we got all these dollars in the United States, but if we're going to pay our workers in Birmingham, well, we need to have British pounds. If we're going to pay our suppliers in Britain, we need British pounds. If we're going to pay British investors for a British company, we need British pounds. So when you think about flows of goods in the trade balance, what you should also be thinking about are flows of money. And in particular, flows of money where when you earned the money abroad, people are trying to trade back into their home currency to whatever extent they can to pay off all their expenses. Now hold that image in your mind, and let's think again about what it means to have a trade deficit. What it presumably means to have a trade deficit is that $166 billion flowed out of the United States, went to these other countries, but was never converted into another currency. We know that those $166 billion in our trade deficit in 1997 that flowed into those other countries, we know that money wasn't used to buy U.S. goods. That was already counted as the trade deficit. We all know it wasn't used to buy U.S. services. That was already counted as part of the trade deficit. But we know that when the dollars and the foreign currencies were all swapped against each other, when everyone did their trade and everyone traded their currencies back and forth, there was this $166 billion left over. Remember that if, when we balanced out all the trade, all the money U.S. companies earned abroad, all the money that foreign companies earned here, if the value of those two things was equal, when they were all traded in the foreign exchange markets, there wouldn't be any trade deficit. It would all balance out. So it must be that the value of what the U.S. shipped abroad was $166 billion bigger, and that somehow that was money which wasn't traded in the markets. Now that raises a perplexing question. If that $166 billion wasn't traded in the markets, what happened to it? Where did it go? Where is it? And understanding the answer to that question is the heart of understanding what economists really mean by a trade deficit. When that $166 billion flows overseas, what ultimately happens to it is that it flows back into U.S. assets in one form or another. It is, to put it this way, invested in the United States. Now, this investment can happen in a variety of different ways. Imagine, for example, a Japanese firm which earns money through imports. It imports to the United States. It doesn't need to spend that money on its workers, or it has some left after it's paid off its workers and so on. And so what that Japanese firm decides to do is not to buy U.S. goods, not to buy U.S. services or anything like that, but to buy, say, stock in a U.S. company, or to buy real estate in the United States, or to buy treasury bonds, or in one form or another to invest that money in the United States. That's some of what happens to that $166 billion. The Japanese company might also say, well, we're just going to put the money in the bank. Well, they take the dollars, they go put them in the bank. Of course, the bank wants to invest the money somehow so it can pay interest. So the bank would use that money and buy treasury bonds or something like that. Students sometimes say to me, well, can't the Japanese company just keep the money? Well, you can keep money, but you wouldn't keep U.S. dollars without investing them in anything. I mean, a big corporation with billions of dollars at stake doesn't take dollar bills and stash them under the bed. One way or another, they put them in a bank, they put them in a financial system. Or else, they go to the foreign exchange markets, they would trade those dollars for yen, and then whoever gets the dollars would face exactly the same choice. Maybe that person who gets those dollars would be someone who wants to invest in the United States, who wants to put money, who wants to buy U.S. stocks, U.S. bonds, U.S. land, U.S. companies, to somehow invest the money in the United States. But ultimately, that $166 billion does flow back to the United States, but instead of flowing back to buy goods and services, it flows back simply in the form of capital, which is invested in the U.S. economy. That point is central and important, so let me make it a couple of different ways. One way of thinking about it is just to say that whenever a country has a trade deficit, what that trade deficit measures, by definition really, is how much capital is flowing into the country from abroad. It shows that, on balance, the U.S. is borrowing from other countries. Conversely, whenever you have a trade surplus, that means you're lending abroad. Now let's think about that in a couple different ways, all of which are equivalent. If you just have one country in the world that country can only consume what it produces. After all, if there's just one country, that's all there is. But if you have many countries in the world, it becomes possible to have a situation where you produce more than you consume. You produce more than you consume, and you ship the extra overseas. When you ship the extra overseas, then you have a trade surplus. It's the situation Japan has been in. Producing more than it consumes, shipping the extra overseas. Then you have all this money you earned from shipping that extra overseas. Well, what do you do with that money? You invest that money abroad as well. So the trade surplus measures your flow of money abroad. You can also be a country like the United States. And the United States is in a situation where, because of the global economy, it can consume more than it produces. It can consume more than it produces by buying stuff from abroad. And as it buys stuff from abroad, it can bring in extra goods, more than it is actually producing. Well, how do you pay for that? How do you pay for that situation where you're consuming more than you produce? And the answer is, you borrow the money from abroad. And the trade deficit measures precisely, from a macroeconomic point of view, how much extra is flowing in goods and services, and how much did you need to borrow from abroad in order to pay for those goods and services. Another way to think about it. If you think about it in terms of the total capital that's available in the U.S. economy, you can think about a situation where we think of the total amount of quantity supplied in an economy and the total amount of money demanded in an economy. That is to say, with supplied money, we're talking about sources of capital. With demand for money, we're talking about those who borrow money in one form or another. Now, what are the basic sources of capital, if we think about this in broad macroeconomic international terms? Well, one source of capital would be domestic saving, as we talked about in capital markets. Another source of capital would be foreign saving. Or to put it differently, it would be borrowing foreign saving, borrowing from abroad. On the demand side for capital, we have those people who want to borrow in order to invest, and those folks are going to be on the demand side of the market. If the government is running a deficit, then the government will also be part of the demand for capital. If the government is running a surplus, then the government is saving money, and the government would be an additional possible source of supply of capital. So when we think about this kind of a balance, that the sources of capital would be private saving, since we now have a surplus, it would be government saving, and borrowing from abroad, those are all the sources, and those provide the capital for domestic investment. Now, when we think about what's going on in the economy there, what becomes clear is that if you have one economy in the world with no trade out there, then you can only invest as much as you save. Those two need to be linked together, because saving is what makes the capital available for investment purposes. But if you live in a world where capital can flow back and forth across borders, you can actually invest more than your domestic savings, because you borrow the extra from other countries out there in the world. And, like the United States, if you borrow extra from other countries out in the world, you can invest more, but you're consuming less than you would have expected. Bottom line in all this. I've said the same point in 4, 5, 6 different ways now, and I fear that at some point it gets to be a case where repetition doesn't always make it clearer. Bottom line is that if you have a trade deficit, it means by definition, to an economist, means by definition that foreigners on net are investing money in the United States. If you have a trade surplus, it means by definition that on net that economy is investing money abroad. Those things have to be true. This is not a theory of economics where some economists believe one thing and some economists believe another thing. If you understand correctly the notion of the trade balance as involving flows of capital going each direction, then you will understand that when we say a trade deficit or a trade surplus, we mean more was flowing one way than was flowing the other way. And when more was flowing one way than was flowing the other way, that money flows back through flows of capital as investment going abroad. This has sort of odd implications if one thinks about what the trade balance is in this way. It means, for example, that if we didn't have a trade deficit, if the U.S. trade deficit was zero, then there wouldn't be any money flowing overall from foreigners into the U.S. economy. And if there was less capital flowing into the U.S. economy, the U.S. would have to cut back on its amount of investment. In that sense, a trade deficit really means an inflow of capital. And every now and then you'll hear someone say, boy, you know, the trade deficit is just badly named. If we called the trade deficit a capital inflow, then we would all be in favor of it. Conversely, a country like a surplus with Japan, a trade surplus, actually has capital flowing out all the time, year after year, in an amount which exactly is measured by its trade surplus. And again, if you went to Japan and you said, well, you know, this trade surplus you're so proud of, actually that's a capital outflow. I'm not sure the trade surplus would be quite as popular if you called it by that name. But that is, in fact, what it is. The role of government here is clearly to try and step in between these two. If government saves more, then it can be possible for the domestic economy to provide more of its savings. But the government is already in a budget surplus in the late 1990s. That surplus seems likely to continue for at least a few years. So we would have to keep pumping up the surplus bigger and bigger in order to use the government as a way of increasing overall national savings. Is this whole thing about the trade deficit good or bad? If we understand correctly what a trade deficit is, that a trade deficit means borrowing from abroad, that it means being a country when you have a trade deficit which is consuming more than it produces, it manages to consume more than it produces by importing stuff, and it affords that, it's able to afford consuming more than it produces by borrowing from abroad, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Now, this takes us back to all our prejudices about capital markets that we talked about in earlier lectures. There's almost an instinctive reaction, which is borrowing from abroad must be bad. Borrowing is bad. We get a little edgy about the whole idea of borrowing and lending. But actually, there are a variety of examples of countries which borrowed from abroad and things worked out quite well. In fact, one of those examples of a country that borrowed from abroad and had it work out quite well is the United States. The United States in the 19th century. When the United States was building its national infrastructure in the 19th century, including particularly the railroads stretching across the continent, the transcontinental railroads, most of the money for those railroads was raised by selling bonds in Europe. In other words, it was raised by foreign borrowing. Was that borrowing good or bad? Well, that turned out to be good borrowing, and the reason it was good borrowing was that the growth in the U.S. economy as a result of that investment was so strong that the U.S. was often able to pay off the bonds, although truth be told, it defaulted on a number of them as well, but it was able to pay off many of the bonds and then still have growth left over to help the economy as a whole. Another recent example where borrowing from abroad worked out well was an example of South Korea in the 1970s. In the 1970s, South Korea was running trade deficits, it was borrowing from abroad, it was sucking in capital, and as it sucked in capital, that money was, by and large, on average, invested quite sensibly in projects that had a positive and a strong economic payoff. As a result, South Korea was able to pay back its foreign borrowing, and as it paid back its foreign borrowing, it still had money left over. When we think about whether borrowing is sensible or not, this is really the test one wants to apply. And this is true whether you're a country or whether you're an individual. If you borrow money, you bring it into your own, say for your own education or something like that, the real question is, when you borrow it, does it provide a payoff in the future, which helps you pay back the interest on the loan and still end up better than you were? Reverse, though, there are certainly cases where borrowing from abroad worked out badly for countries. And in the 1980s, particularly two of the vivid examples where this happened were Brazil and Mexico. In Brazil and Mexico, we were in a situation where a lot of money was borrowed during the 1970s. It appeared at the time like this was really a good deal for these countries because inflation kept going up and up, and as inflation went up and up, the real rates that these countries were borrowing at were close to zero. In fact, some years they even looked negative. The borrowing looked so good, in fact, that the governments of those countries stepped in and said, we'll guarantee that this money will be repaid. Well, in the early 1980s, inflation goes way down, real interest rates go quite up quite a bit, and all of a sudden those countries are having to borrow back or pay back a lot of money that doesn't look so attractive anymore. Moreover, a lot of that money in Brazil and Mexico, unlike the case of the U.S. with the railroads or South Korea in the 1970s, a lot of that money was sent off and invested in things where there really just wasn't very much of a payoff. The payoff was not very positive. Perhaps the money was used to build half a freeway that stops dead in the Amazon rainforest somewhere, or it was used to build a new oil processing plant which Mexico perhaps didn't really need, or it was used to try and build a steel plant someplace where perhaps there wasn't very much iron ore. A lot of the money was spent in remarkably ineffective, remarkably uneconomical ways. And as interest rates went up and up in the early 1980s, and these were all adjustable rate loans that Brazil and Mexico had made, they found these investments were not paying off any money. They weren't allowing them to repay the loans. At that point, all the borrowers started going broke, and because the governments of Brazil and Mexico had guaranteed those loans, the governments of those countries were on the hook for paying back the money. That was a terrible situation. It led to defaults. It led to near defaults. It led to long, long negotiations year in, year out. It led to banks losing a lot of money who had loaned them money. And it didn't really all get resolved until the early 1990s. But again, the real question when you think about borrowing from abroad is, does the borrowing make sense in the way that it pays back in economic terms, or does it not make sense? And that's really the key that one needs to focus in on. Borrowing in and of itself is not good or bad. And thus, if you think about it for a moment, this would imply that a trade deficit in and of itself is not good or bad. A trade deficit can make perfect sense for a country which is borrowing from abroad and investing the money wisely. However, a trade deficit can be a terrible thing for a country which is borrowing from abroad and then investing the money unwisely. It all comes down to whether or not the amount of investment is a sensible amount and is being used in a wise and sensible way. So where does this leave the United States? Where does it leave the United States trade deficit and judgments about whether that trade deficit is a good thing or a bad thing? Well, as I've said before, the United States is not particularly high in terms of investment among developed economies of the world. And since it's not particularly high in terms of saving and investment, bringing in money from abroad is in some ways a relatively good thing. If we weren't getting that inflow of foreign capital, if we weren't having a trade deficit and getting an inflow of foreign capital, we would be much worse off than we otherwise were. We wouldn't have that money available to invest. However, there are questions about whether that money coming in is really being invested wisely. And these questions go back to more fundamental questions about why did the trade deficit go up so much in the 1980s in the first place? What is it that caused the trade deficit between, what was it, about 1982 and 1987 to go from balance pretty much to a deficit of $167 billion? Sometimes when people talk about this, they talk about things like, well, you know, Japan is just cheating. They're unfair. They treated us badly. They shut out our products. But that explanation, when you look at it, just seems implausible. Japan certainly has unfair trade. They certainly don't treat U.S. products fairly. But there's no reason to believe that their unfairness suddenly increased in an incredibly large way from 1983 to 1987. If anything, the general trend in Japan, although it's a slow trend, has been toward being slightly more open to U.S. products over that time. You can't explain the arrival of the trade deficit by saying, oh boy, Japan suddenly became much more unfair over those 4 years. But something else did happen over those few years, something else which is relevant here. And that is that the federal budget deficit explodes in size during the early 1980s. That is to say, the demand for capital in the United States explodes because the government is borrowing so much more. We'll talk about this more in the next lecture, but budget deficits get very large in the mid-1980s. Now think for a moment about what these budget deficits mean in relationship to the trade deficit. If the U.S. is borrowing lots and lots of money, then when Japanese folks earn dollars by selling in the United States, or German folks earn dollars by selling in the United States, or British folks earn dollars in the United States, instead of using those dollars to buy U.S. goods and services, and remember, if they bought U.S. goods and services with the dollars, the trade deficit would be zero. Instead, that money was invested in U.S. government bonds. Now, it may not have been invested directly, but it went into the financial system, it was stored up, and eventually, one way and another, it flowed through the financial system from person to person and came out being invested in the United States. In other words, the reason the United States had a very large trade deficit in the mid-1980s is because we had an explosion of borrowing. We had an explosion of borrowing from abroad and then spending that money in the United States. Well, did we spend that money wisely or not? Do we spend that money wisely like the U.S. did in the 19th century when it built railroads, wisely like South Korea did in the 1970s, or were we spending it more somewhat foolishly like Brazil and Mexico did in the 1980s? Well, clearly the U.S. wasn't quite as foolish as Brazil and Mexico. It would almost be difficult to be as foolish as they were. But in general, when the U.S. was borrowing money and running large budget deficits, that money was not going into future investment. It wasn't going into some modern equivalent of the railroads. It wasn't going into wiring the country for the internet or putting computers everywhere or rebuilding the highway system or something that would really perhaps have long-term payoff for the economy as a whole. Instead, it's probably more accurate to say that it was going into things like defense spending and Social Security and health care, all of which are perfectly worthwhile public goals, but when you think about them in the long term, they're not things which increase the growth rate of the economy long term. They aren't investments in physical capital or human capital or new technology. They're more like spending money now on groceries, where you've spent it, or maybe on a fancy vacation, where you spend it, and if you borrowed that money, you have to pay it back a long time in the future, even though the vacation is over or the groceries are consumed, and that particular expenditure, you had all the pleasure out of it you were going to have. So the concern for the U.S. economy, the concern for the trade deficit is that we borrowed all this money during the 1980s, we're continuing to borrow more during the 1990s, and as we've borrowed it, it's not clear that we've had an investment boom to go with it. Now, in this sense, the trade deficit of the 1990s is a little bit different than the trade deficit of the 1980s. When the trade deficit first took off during the 1980s, it was fairly clear to most economists that the underlying reason really was the budget deficit. The large budget deficit was leading to more investment or more money being sucked in from abroad. And so the trade deficit, the flow of capital into the country, was in a sense being sucked in by the large federal budget deficit. But in the late 1990s, we no longer have a large federal budget deficit. In fact, we have something of a surplus. But we still have the large trade deficit. So where is the money going now? Well, it must be now that since the money is not flowing into the government trade deficit, the money must be flowing into the United States in other ways. For example, it may be flowing into U.S. stocks and bonds. And one of the reasons that the U.S. stock market's doing so well, presumably, is that foreign investors are seeing it as a sensible place to put their money. It also, to some extent, would be flowing into the U.S. economy for purposes of business investment, which we hope in the long term will pay off in a more rapid growth rate. In this sense, the trade deficit of the 1990s is perhaps something to worry about a little bit less than the trade deficit of the 1980s. It seemed clear that the trade deficit of the 1980s was really about one-time consumption, a consumption boom that we might have to pay off in the long term. The trade deficit of the 1990s looks like it's coming along with an investment boom. And so perhaps, cross one's fingers, it will pay for itself, at least to some extent. Let me try and conclude this lecture by drawing out some of the implications of this way of thinking about the trade deficit. Implications that I think are really different from what a lot of people believe about the way the economy works. First of all, the overall trade deficit matters. It matters because it describes a flow of capital coming from into this country from abroad. However, it's the overall trade deficit that matters, not the trade deficit between any two countries, not the bilateral trade deficit, as it is sometimes called. You'll hear people say, the U.S. has a trade deficit with Japan of this much, or with Germany of this much. From an economic point of view, the deficit with a particular country really doesn't matter that much. In the world as a whole, you would expect the economy to have deficits with some countries and surpluses with other countries. If those more or less balanced each other out, then, more or less, the trade deficit would be zero. And as a result, we just wouldn't worry that much about some countries being negative and some countries being positive. This is a lesson which is relatively obvious to economists and relatively not obvious to most other people. One of my favorite stories about it is a few years ago during the Bush administration when an economist named Michael Boskin was head of Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. At a press conference, people were asking him about the bilateral trade deficit with Japan. And Boskin, as he later told the story, said that he just gave the economist answer. The economist answer is, who cares about the bilateral trade deficit with Japan? That's completely irrelevant to anything. We care about the overall trade deficit, but the fact that there is a deficit with one particular country doesn't mean anything in a broad economic sense. And when he said this, the press corps laughed, ha ha ha, at this way in which he was completely ignoring a relevant and important question and just went on asking him. They completely disbelieved the argument that it just really didn't matter what was happening between two individual countries. A second implication. When we talk about the trade deficit, unfair trade is not conceivably the source of the trade deficit that we've got. When you think about the trade deficit in the United States, and you think about that pattern, balance, 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 all through the 1950s and 1960s, and then all of a sudden huge deficits in the 1980s, almost back to balance, huge deficits again in the late 1990s, that picture is not a picture where you can explain it looking at trading practices of other countries. There is no one out there who seriously argues that trade was really fair in the 1950s and 60s. Japan hardly blocked any U.S. products at all in the 1950s and 60s, and that's why the U.S. had balance in the 1950s and 60s. Anyone who knows anything about the Japanese economy or the German economy will tell you trade was grossly unfair in those years, much more unfair than it is now. So it doesn't fit. And then all of a sudden the U.S. trade deficit gets hugely bigger in the early 1980s. Well, that's not a time when Japan suddenly became grossly unfair in trade. There's no evidence of that at all. What happened instead was the U.S. began demanding more capital from abroad. And demanding more capital from abroad is what the trade deficit means, remember. By 1991, that's the year the U.S. is getting these big payments from other countries. It's also a year that the U.S. economy is in something of a recession, and as a result, we're just not buying that much from abroad. So our imports aren't very high, and we get to a place where we're close to a balance of trade in that one year. But by the late 1990s, the U.S. is in a position where we're demanding lots of capital from abroad for investment purposes, and we're buying lots of stuff from abroad. So we have high imports, lots of money coming in terms of investment capital, and again, no one argues, just no one, that the big problem with the 1990s is that all of a sudden other countries have become much more unfair to U.S. products. That explanation that unfairness causes the balance of trade problem is simply illogical on its face if you try and match the time pattern. A third issue. The trade balance probably has no effect, really, on either the number of jobs in the economy or the wage levels in the economy. Let me make each of those points separately. But why does it have no effect on the number of jobs in the economy? Presumably because the trade in and of itself does not much affect frictional unemployment. It doesn't much affect structural unemployment, which remember is about domestic laws, and it doesn't much affect cyclical unemployment. Sometimes people like to pretend that if we could sell a whole lot more abroad, then the economy would suddenly grow a whole lot more. There'd be a lot more demand in the economy. But that seems unlikely. The Federal Reserve, which we'll talk about in Lecture 16, really has power over the economy. And if there was all of a sudden a big surge of demand, they would be worried about demand pull inflation. And they would tend to slow the economy down to counterbalance that. It's probably true that trade affects wages in the United States. But trade and the trade deficit are different things. It's perfectly possible, for example, to have a lot of trade in the economy. Trade could be 30, 40, 50% of gross domestic product. But the trade deficit could be zero, as long as overall imports and overall exports balanced each other out in the current account balance. So the fact that trade affects wages by forcing U.S. workers to compete with workers abroad can be true. But the trade deficit is not necessarily related to how much trade is out there. Again, you could have a lot of trade and a deficit of pretty much zero, or you could have very little trade. Maybe trade might be only 3, 4% of GDP, but you could have a big gap between imports and exports. In that case, because trade was so small, it would have a much smaller effect on wages in the economy. So the level of trade will affect wages, but the trade deficit is a different issue. A fourth indicator. If we think about the trade imbalance as a matter of saving and investment, as a matter of capital flowing into this country, it becomes clear that simple protectionism, like shutting out imports, is not going to be a very good answer to that question. I'll talk much more about protectionism and issues of trade once we get on to Lecture 18. But in general, if we shut out imports, we don't let people earn dollars in the United States, then they won't have those dollars to lend to the United States. And if they don't have those dollars to lend to the United States, the U.S. won't be able to invest that money. We're dependent on that foreign capital. It would be great if we could save more, but we don't quite know how to do that. A fifth implication. Think about this for a moment. If you're just talking about people, would you expect poor people to lend money to rich people or rich people to lend money to poor people? Most people, that's not a hard question. You expect the rich to lend to the poor because the rich have the money. Globally speaking, the same pattern is typically expected, that rich countries with a lot of capital should be lending to poor countries with not very much capital. When the United States is running this enormous trade deficit, we're in a sort of unprecedented situation, a situation where the U.S. is not loaning abroad, as one might expect a rich country to do, but money is flowing into the United States from abroad, where poor countries are loaning to rich countries. It's not clear how sustainable that is because we've never really seen a pattern like this in the U.S. economy. Ultimately, if we want to get rid of the trade deficit, what we need to think about is being more dependent on our own domestic savings. If we had been dependent on our own domestic savings in the 1980s and we hadn't run those enormous budget deficits, then we wouldn't have started the trade deficit in the first place. If we had a higher level of savings now, then we wouldn't need the capital from abroad to keep flowing in order to pump up the U.S. investment boom of the 1990s. In this sense, the agenda for getting rid of the trade deficit is very similar to the agenda for increasing productivity growth. At root, they both say that we need to increase our domestic level of saving and investment. Because if we rely on our own domestic savings, then as that money gets invested, the benefits and the returns will all flow to United States citizens. It will all flow into this country, rather than having some of those benefits and some of those gains flow abroad.